is case number 73014, Sitton versus the State of Nevada. We have here Mr. Orme representing the appellant, Mr. Stanton, the state. As you can see, we have Justices Silver and Kadish are in Las Vegas right now. There's reasons I asked them to stay in Las Vegas. That's why they apologize for not being in Carson City, but it's at my request to do so. They will be participating fully in this argument. Justice Stiglitz will also participate. She is watching the arguments online right at the moment, but she is out of town on reasons which I excused her from appearing today, but she will also participate in the final decision of this case. So with that in mind, we have a 60-minute argument here. Mr. Orme got a lot of issues. Would you like to reserve some time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. I've asked to reserve 10 minutes.
Very well. Okay. You may proceed.
May it please the Court, my name is Christopher Orme. I represent Mr. Sitton. Mr. Sitton was sentenced to death. One of the main issues I want to concentrate on today is what I would refer to as a blatant Bruton violation that occurred in this case. This case was tried all the way through the trial phase, and it went to the jury in the first trial. And unfortunately, the jury was accidentally given the co-defendant Jackie Schaefer's statements. It became apparent to us that the jurors were reading those statements.
How did that happen?
Apparently, the clerk of the court, there'd be motions to suppress her statements, and when the evidence was taken back, apparently the clerk of the court delivered those statements. And it was during jury deliberations that one of the jurors made a comment that they needed a CD player, and then it became apparent that a mistrial was in order. The reason I tell you that is because Jackie Schaefer's statements never came in the first trial, nor did the state ever make any attempt to introduce them against Will Sitton. We filed a motion to sever pretrial. The state responded by saying that they were not, under any circumstances, going to use Jackie Schaefer's statement against Will Sitton. And they actually said, they cite to Bruton in their opposition and said, they cannot use it to incriminate another co-defendant. And if there was going to be any use of Jackie Schaefer's statements, we would not have any identification of Will Sitton. They actually used the word others, because they're going to do a complete about-face. So I went through the first trial. It ended in mistrial. They hadn't done any of the introduction of Jackie Schaefer's statements. Then some curious things occurred in the second trial. The second trial starts, and now Jackie Schaefer's attorney has a different tactic. I understand why. I think he thought the first trial didn't go particularly well. All of a sudden, they start talking about potential domestic violence issues. I move for severance again. Co-defendant's attorney says, well, he's going to move for severance 400 times. Then the judge kicks us out, the prosecution and the defense. We're told to leave. And when we're told to leave, the prosecutor bitterly begins to complain.
Both sides were told to leave by the judge, or what? What happened?
Both the prosecution and Will Sitton and his attorneys were told to leave. Jackie Schaefer gets to stay, and so does her attorney. And they're going to discuss severance. Mm-hmm. And before that, the prosecutor starts telling the judge, you can't have this. This is a secret proceeding. You can't do this. Didn't matter. We were sent to the jury deliberation room where the prosecutor bitterly begins to complain about that. The prosecutor then files a motion the next day, shortly after.
Was the state represented in that proceeding?
Nobody was, other than.
So there was something going on with the state even being there.
Yes. And in fact, this court on appeal unsealed that hearing. I was never able to obtain what it was. And Jackie Schaefer's attorney, and this becomes important to this Bruton issue, tells the district court judge, my client's going to testify, and my client's going to incriminate both Robert Sitton, who's the state star witness, and my client, Will Sitton. So now the judge knows Jackie Schaefer's going to testify. She never does. I did not know that until I was writing this appeal and this court unsealed the records. The prosecution then files a written motion during trial, and a portion of it is found on page 42 of my opening brief. Unfortunately, for the defense counsel, there is absolutely no case law or statute that shows ex parte communications are ever appropriate in arguments for or against motions to sever. Defense counsel doesn't get to make wantonly vague references as to why severance is necessary and then be allowed to have an ex parte communication where they specifically state the reasons for severance on a record to be sealed. There are reasons why court hearings are public and all parties are present. There was absolutely no legal basis for the ex parte communication to have occurred after Defendant Schaefer moved for a motion to sever. Furthermore, the state says, seeing that it is Defendant Schaefer's burden to prove why severance is necessary, obviously the state and counsel for Defendant Sitton should have been present to both hear arguments made by Schaefer's counsel and argue in opposition. It was a sealed hearing. A man sentenced to death, and I don't even know what was said. What's more problematic is now the court knows something, or believes the court knows something, that nobody else knows except for Jackie Schaefer's statements. Jackie Schaefer's going to testify. Then what occurs is when I come back in the courtroom, the judge is going to find severance. Okay, good. That's what I asked for. Then the prosecution gets angry, and there's a break, and then the judge comes back and says, well, I've talked to the chief judge, and I've changed my mind. Severance isn't going to be granted. So at this point, from Mr. Sitton's point of view, I've been kicked out of a courtroom. I don't know what the arguments for severance have been. I've been told severance is going to be granted. Now severance is not going to be granted, and I still can't figure out why. The prosecution is bitterly complaining about me getting kicked out of the courtroom. Then, after almost everyone has testified and the lead detective was up on the stand, here comes the state. What the state proceeds to do, and all of the quotes from what the state does with Jackie Schaefer's statement is found on pages 29 through 31 of my opening brief. They proceed to ask the detective direct violations of Bruton, direct violations of this court's decision in Martin and Duxworth, and direct violation of this court's one finding in Denver's, where the court found it was Bruton violation. Here they go. They proceed to start saying, now, if I could just give you a little factual background, my client and his brother were accused of both Jackie Schaefer.
Mr. Oram, I need you to stay by the mic, please.
Sorry.
Yeah, it's very hard for us to hear you, so if you move away, we can't hear you.
Sorry.
That's okay.
So in this, the factual scenario was my client and his brother supposedly went over to Jackie Schaefer's house where her roommate, the victim, was present. Supposedly, my client, Jackie Schaefer, and my client's brother then proceed to beat this man to death in his bedroom. Those are the only four players involved. It is our contention at trial that Robert Sitton, my client's brother, must have gotten drunk while moving out. He admitted he was drunk, and he admitted he punched the victim several times. So he committed the crime in an impulsive act. That was our argument at trial. Robert Sitton got up and said, oh, yeah, I beat the guy up, and I did it with Will Sitton. I argued you need corroboration under Hagelmeyer, and I got a Hagelmeyer instruction. They had no science linking my client to this crime, nothing. It really was Robert Sitton. So now, in the second trial, they then begin to offer Jackie Schaefer's statements. Words to the effect were, there's some people who helped you move out? Yes. Were there some people, were you told, did you tell someone that the victim had made advances, sexual advances towards you? Yes. Were there other people inside Brian Haskell's room? Yes. Others were in the room. Did you know he was going to be hurt that badly? No, I didn't know others were going to hurt him that badly. I didn't think he'd be hurt that badly. I was nervous when others were in the room. The others were in the room for 15 minutes. The others carried his TV out, the victim's TV out. It goes on and on and on. When it first started, I moved for mistrial. As soon as they start talking about others in the room, I'm like, oh my goodness. That's Jackie Schaefer saying Robert Sitton and Will Sitton are in the room and they're killing the victim. I can't cross-examine it. There's nothing I can do. I approach. I identify for the court Bruton. I identify for the court this court's decision in Duxworth and Martin. Mistrial is overruled and the state will not stop. They continue to bring out others. Others did this. Others did that. Three times I object after the mistrial to the point where I'm concerned about the jury viewing me constantly. Obviously, my client is...
At some point, there was a direct reference to the laptop, and I think there was some evidence presented at that time that your client wanted the laptop.
Yes.
And so I think at that some point in this questioning, there was reference to a laptop that others wanted, right?
Yes.
So that, you're saying that linked directly to your client.
That does, that links directly to my client, but all of it linked directly to the client. I really think that, that you would have to have a really, a person with an extraordinarily low IQ who wouldn't realize what the state was doing. The state was simply mirroring Robert Sitton through Jackie Schaefer. That's what they were doing over and over and over and over. I put in the briefs how much it just linked. They were just absolutely, when Robert Sitton said something, Jackie Schaefer would mirror it. And the state was just picking and choosing against over all of my objections. And so, to me, it was obvious what they were able to do with Jackie Schaefer. Did she testify? No. Could I cross-examine her? No. Has this court ruled that what happened here is improper? Yes. This court followed Bruton in Martin and Duxworth, with the exception in Martin and Duxworth that Kenya Krall was the person who said the co-defendant confessed and implicated Mr. Martin. Others, that's how they tried to do it, we and others. This court condemned that. Then I was the attorney in the Luxor bomber, and I have supplemented with the case of last month when it came down from federal court. And in the Luxor bomber, the state did the same thing. They brought out the co-defendant's statement, and we did this, we did that, they did this. And this court condemned it. This court said that's a Bruton violation. Now, the court may have reasonable disagreement with the federal court as to whether it was harmless. I'm not here to pick on that. What I wanted to point out was that this court found it was error. It found it was a Bruton error. This court found it was a Bruton error in Duxworth and Martin. Bruton articulates the standard. And what have they done? They continue to ignore it. And that's why I really wanted to point out Denver's as well. Although this court may have found harmless, this court may have found harmless, it condemned it and said it was a Bruton violation. So why does the state then go down in a subsequent capital trial and say, we're going to do the same thing again, this time worse than Bruton, or this time worse than Denver's. We're going to do it over and over and over, and we don't care what this court says. This court has condemned it. The federal courts have condemned it. The United States Supreme Court has condemned it. And they're doing nothing. They're just thumbing their nose. And when I see the case get overturned, some of these cases get overturned, I think of judicial economy as well. Why are they blatantly violating the law? And so as I look at this, and I look at Bruton, I look at Denver's, and I look at Martin and Duxworth, I don't see a distinction. They can't even raise a distinction. In fact, in their brief, they never once addressed the fact that in severance below, they said, we will not use Jacqueline Schaefer's statement. They didn't address it. I put it in the brief. Why did you tell me that? And then in the second trial, do an about face. They don't touch that at all. Another thing they don't touch is they say, well, this sealed hearing, what's the relevance of that? That's not what they said below. That's not what the prosecutor said. The prosecutor was infuriated at the sealed hearing and complained bitterly about it. So it makes it curious to me why, now that we're on appeal, now all of a sudden the standard's different for the state. They're talking out of two sides of their mouth. But in essence, this was the most damning information and evidence against Mr. Sitton. I want to read from the U.S. Supreme Court in Bruton because it directly applies to this case. It almost looks like it was written for this if you substitute out the names of the defendants. Here, the introduction of Evans' confession posed a substantial threat to petitioner's right to confront the witness against him, and this is a hazard we cannot ignore. Despite the conceitedly clear instruction to the jury to disregard Evans' inadmissible hearsay evidence, inculpating petitioner in the context of a joint trial, we cannot accept limiting instructions as an adequate substitute for petitioner's constitutional right to cross-examine. The reason I bring that up is look at how the state is arguing to you. There was a limiting instruction here. That's what they argued in Martin and Duxworth, and this court rejected. That's what they argued. The United States argued in Bruton, and the United States Supreme Court rejected. When they argued that in Denver's, this court found error. Again, this court may have found harmless, but that's not what federal court has found. U.S. Supreme Court went on, such a context is presented here where the powerfully created extrajudicial statement of a co-defendant who stands accused side by side with the defendant are deliberately spread before the jury in a joint trial. Not only are the incriminations devastating to the defendant, but their credibility is inevitably suspect, a fact recognized when accomplices do not take the stand and the jury is instructed to weigh the testimony carefully, given the recognized motivation to shift the blame onto others. The unreliability of such evidence is intolerably compounded when the alleged accomplice, as here, does not testify and cannot be tested by cross-examination. How can I test Jackie Schaefer? I can't. I had to sit there. But once that was occurring, if you were actually at the trial, you knew the trial was over because the jury had seen me vigorously cross-examining people throughout. What was I going to say to the detectives? Who do you mean? Oh, yeah, your client. What was I going to do? So all of a sudden, there's a big portion of the detective's testimony that I'm not touching with a 10-foot pole. I can't, because I know who those others are, and so does the jury. So how do I protect against it, and how is that not a violation of the Confrontation Clause? The state cited to a couple of cases, saying, talking about jury instructions. How does that take away from the fact that Crawford versus Washington condemns testimonial hearsay? So now, if we go to what is the standard for harmless error, could this be deemed harmless? How can this possibly be deemed harmless? One of the ways the state would like to argue, oh, well, there's overwhelming evidence. Where? Where was the overwhelming evidence? And if they had overwhelming evidence, why are they cheating like this? Over and over and over again. And I wonder if we don't, you know, when Martin and Duxworth came out in 1997, I actually was at the law firm working on that particular case. And from that point on, the generation of major violators, Dan Seaton, Mel Harmon, those type of very experienced, fine prosecutors, stopped behaving or trying to get around and subvert the Confrontation Clause. Now, we've seen it in Denver's, we see it here, and no matter when the court says it's error, why does the state continue to push the envelope and say, well, they found it was error, but maybe we could convince them that it was harmless? Because if that's the standard, then doesn't that mean that they're intentionally inflicting error, intentionally putting error into the record for this court to then decide? And here is a case where a man's being sentenced to death, and this is what they have done. The antagonistic defenses, part of severance that I had argued, I had realized that Mr. Tomchek, who was Jacqueline Schaefer's counsel, and did a fine job. I have no qualms with what he was doing. He was trying to help his client, and that hurt my client. That's what he was trying to do. But in the second trial, there started to be mention about domestic violence. I couldn't stop it. That's why that sealed hearing is so troublesome, because as I was kicked out, and then severance was granted, and then severance was taken away, just didn't know what had been said. Didn't know what was said, but now that I look back at it, I think I would submit, although I can't crawl into the district court judge's head, that what the district court judge thought is when the state was presenting all of Jackie Schaefer's statements, and I was saying it's a Bruton violation, it's Confrontation Clause violation, that he thought it isn't going to be. She's going to get up on that witness stand, and then she'll be subject to cross-examination. This isn't an issue, but it didn't happen, and I didn't know that. And if I'd known it, I would have told the judge, don't let it in, subject to her testimony, do something not to let that happen. But as I see it, I see I only have a minute and a half left. I cannot see how this is distinguishable from Bruton. I cannot see it at all. And the state has not been able to enlighten us at all in their answering brief. How can this be distinguished from Bruton? How is this different than Martin and Duxworth? How is this different than Denver's? It's blatant Confrontation Clause violation. If there are no questions for me, I'd like to reserve the rest for rebuttal.
You have a little over 11 minutes, and you reserve that for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Mr. Stanton.
Good afternoon. My name is David Stanton. I represent the state in this matter. What you just heard was a plea, passionate in its nature, to this court about how can the state proceed in prosecution when you have joint defendants and the state elects to admit one of the defendant's statements or at trial. And the simple reason is the same court that ruled on Bruton in the next several decades answered that direct question repeatedly, often, and with the same stream of consciousness in each one of those decisions. Gray, Richardson, and March, the United States Supreme Court said that the statement of a defendant at trial can be admitted if it is redacted in a neutral fashion, so that it is not facially incriminatory to the other non-testifying or other defendant at trial.
How can you say this is neutral when there were clearly four people in the room, including the deceased, and you're making references to others?
Well, I think
who else is there? How is that neutral?
I think the error in that analysis is not based upon what other evidence is being applied to the state, because that's a very critical component when you're dealing with Bruton issues. It is whether the statement as introduced to the 12 is facially incriminatory about who is involved in the statement. What's not appropriate in the analysis is to use the other evidence at trial that clearly, when the state is tasked with proving someone's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, as in this case, there's a multitude of evidence from other areas. The neighbor who sees the appellant at the home, the property that was stolen from the victim found in the appellant's residence. Sure, there's, in every case since Bruton where this has occurred, there is other evidence outside of the redacted statements that one could infer who is involved. But that's not the test. That's not what Bruton says. That's not what Bruton is designed to protect. And that's not what the progeny of Bruton says.
Practical effect of this. You can't give an unredacted statement, right? It needs to be redacted. To the identity of the defendant.
In the scenarios we're talking about, correct?
Yes. But the effect essentially is the same thing as if you hadn't redacted it.
I couldn't disagree with you more, because it's not, once again, the analysis is what does the redacted statement say to the 12? And along with the contemporaneous Tavares instruction, both at the time of the admission and in the jury instructions. In fact, the progeny of after Bruton repeatedly talks about remedies to facilitate maintaining joinder, and the major remedy that they're citing to is the instruction about who the evidence can only be used against. So if you're going to adopt the appellant's rule of Bruton, you're going to change 40 years of jurisprudence in all the federal districts, circuit courts, and in every state that I'm aware of, because there's no jurisdiction that has adopted a redacted Bruton statement to now say that it's, in essence, a Crawford violation, that it is a violation of one's right to cross-examine their accusers. And in this particular case is compelling, because in all the other cases that Mr. Orem just cited to you, none of them involve the facts that were unique in this case. That is, there was a co-conspirator who testified, and that was Mr. Sitton's brother. And so, Mr. Orem,
Mr. Stanton, I had a question. Mr. Orem made mention that originally the state had opposed in writing or the motion to sever, saying that they weren't going to use the statement, and then late in the first trial it was not used. What changed then in the second trial?
I don't think that the record shows that the state made a comment to the trial court that it was not going to use the statement either in the first trial or the second trial. What Mr. Oren objects to and what's in his brief is that the state, in its written opposition, said it was not going to be using the statement against Mr. Sitton, and thus the, you know, maintaining the integrity of Bruton, but not, I don't think the state's representation was that they weren't going to use the statement in total at either time.
Okay.
So the question, in the way it's phrased by Mr. Oren, that somehow the state, in the question by Justice Silver, is, you know, is there something that changed the fabric of the trial from the first one to the second one that caused the state to do it? And Mr. Oren passionately states that there's some nefarious reason why prosecutors habitually violate the rule of Bruton. Well, we don't make that decision in a unilateral fashion. The decision of whether or not admission of evidence comports with Bruton, violates Bruton, is not for me to make. That's for the trial judge to make. And as the prosecutor, along with Mr. Warren, in the Rueda Denver's case, would submit he's comparing apples and oranges in a very significant way, and he's talking about some habitual attempt by prosecutors to get around the rule of Bruton by admitting statements implicating co-defendants.
Mr. Sain, can you just clarify for me? I'm a little bit confused on the facts. And Mr. Warren was saying that a statement was inadvertently submitted by the clerk's office or the court clerk to the jury, I guess what the admitted exhibits. And I don't know, is this an unredacted Schaefer statement or what? What was that?
Unfortunately, Your Honor, I was not trial counsel in the first trial and the second trial. I am arguing this because both of the prosecutors, Ms. Lucich and Ms. Bluth, are currently in trials right now
okay. In
this case. So as I understood the story, because the story certainly made the courthouse rounds, was is that it was a transcript of Ms. Schaefer's that was admitted as evidence in a pretrial hearing, and that the court mistakenly thought that the statement was in evidence for purposes of the trial, and that it was evidence for the jury to review in the jury deliberation.
Well, that sounds pretty prejudicial to me. I mean, and not the state's fault, but how do you deal with that?
Well, the case was mistried, and they picked a brand new jury sometime later.
Oh, okay.
and led to this conviction in a sanitized version.
I want to return, though, to the redaction point, because I'm not sure I understand what you're saying the law of Bruton is. Reading this statement, it is hard for me, being somewhat familiar with this record, to think that the statement, somebody or they, refers to anyone other than Will Sitton. And I also wonder why some pieces of that statement were put in, because they weren't, unless under some rule of completeness issue, but they didn't seem to me to inculpate Ms. Schaefer nearly so much as they inculpated Sitton and reinforced Robert's testimony. So I look at that, and you redact something, that doesn't mean that it's carte blanche to use whatever you want. It can't turn into a wink and a nod consistent with the Constitution. So what is the rule of law here? What's the test that we should be applying to review these statements?
Well,
I'm really troubled with this.
I think by kind of your comments, and I'm going to draw from a comment made by Mr. Oren in his brief, that I think speaks directly to that issue. Ultimately, to answer your question directly, the test is to be used is kind of the progeny from the United States Supreme Court.
In Gray,
which I think speaks directly to the test for trial courts and for the test for this court to apply. Does the statement that the jury hears in redacted form facially incriminate one of the defendants.
But we don't have to dumb it down to the point where we remove all knowledge that of context. I mean, context is everything, especially in a trial.
Certainly. And as in this case, it was patently obvious from the evidence presented that more than one person was involved in the murder and the robbery and the attendant criminal acts here. So the texture and the context that the statement gives is the neutral pronoun that does not readily identify the person other than the statement is admitted for.
Well, we know it wasn't Schaefer because Schaefer's the declarant, and we know it wasn't Haskell because Haskell wouldn't be doing this. So we know it's either Robert or Sitton, right? I mean, there's nobody else there.
Well, that's true as the jury heard it from the other evidence, but that's not the case when, you know, a juror or others read a redacted statement. Certainly, the context of the rest of the trial applying that test, one can conclude the finite number of individuals involved. But that's not the test that the court articulated in Gray. And what they found was the method of redaction, that is, cutting out and leaving blanks. You could infer, because there's using and, that there were two people involved, as opposed to the term of others. And even
but Mr. Stanton, in this case, there's other parts of the statement from Ms. Schaefer herself that were put into evidence through the detective where she identified Mr. Sitton, Will Sitton, as her boyfriend and talked about having told someone about this victim having touched her in a way she felt was inappropriate, and that person was upset about it, and talked about Mr. Will Sitton wanting a laptop as well. So there were some parts of her statement that referred directly to him, even though other parts were redacted. So doesn't that provide for a more direct reference to this defendant than in some other redaction circumstances?
I would agree with you. I would agree with you that there are other redactions in cases where the redactions are replete throughout and that do not reference whether the subject matter is something less, not as inculpatory as the direct acts of, say, the murder or the robbery. But once again, the complained of aspects here is that there's other evidence that fills in the blanks. And that issue has been addressed for 30 or 40 decades by both state and federal courts time and time again. And the answer to the question is that if on its face the statement does not directly implicate the other defendant, then that is a proper redaction pursuant to Bruce.
Sure, but here we have the juxtaposition of actual statements that she made within her statement as reported by the detective. In other words, it's not completely redacted in her statement and then other people's statements or other evidence fills in the blanks. I understand your point there. But here, within the report of her statements themselves, are references to this defendant.
I agree, as I mentioned to you before. I also think that in those examples that you cited to and that Mr. Orme cited to in his brief, those are ones that both the trial court found not to be in violation of Bruton, and I would submit they're not. Because once again, the redacted form of the statement, there are a number of people that were involved in this case that the jury could have imagined were the redacted neutral aspects of this case.
Who in particular?
The brother, for sure, because that was Mr. Sitton's defense at trial. I mean, Mr. Orme comes up here and pronounces, as he does in his brief, that this is a case triggering the Chartier case, which I was the prosecutor on, and I have some comments, at least with my time, hopefully I'd like to address with you about that decision. But, and he cites the term that it's an antagonistic defense. Well, putting aside whether or not it was or wasn't, was not in the Chartier-Wilcox case, in this case it wasn't, because the defenses could not even be remotely deemed to be antagonistic to one another. Mr. Sitton's defense at trial, and Mr. Oren just repeated it to you, is that Robert Sitton, his brother, was the killer. He had no involvement in that. And the defense of Ms. Schaefer is that the state had insufficient evidence to prove her guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. There is nothing about those two defenses that are antagonistic, let alone the bell that needs to be rung in order to establish severance, and that is they're mutually exclusive, which is an exceedingly rare set of circumstances where you would have defenses that are legally defined as mutually exclusive. So there are three ways to establish severance. You can, as I just mentioned, have a case where there is a mutually exclusive defense proffered in the same trial. Second, you can have a joinder that is so prejudicial that it does not reflect a reliable verdict. The common one seen on appeal is what they refer to as the spillover effect. One defendant taken along to a trial where the overwhelming evidence is as to the other defendant or defendants, and that they get convicted by the vortex of the case that surrounds them.
Let me ask you this. With the domestic violence allegations that she was trying to have admitted, didn't the judge essentially say at one point that that evidence would be prejudicial if it came in? And I had the impression he had the inclination at that point to sever.
I think the judge, by my reading of the record, was very sensitive to that issue, and depending on how the evidence would progress during the trial, would make his ruling, tip his hand to making that ruling of severance if and when it occurred.
But going to the severance aspect of this, doesn't that make it an antagonistic defense? She's now pointing the finger at him and saying, he's violent.
Well,
and she changed her trial strategy from the first trial.
Well, with all due respect, that's not the evidence that the jury heard. That's
right.
Clearly what they might have been attempting to do if the court was going to allow that door to be opened.
Right, and it was just the neighbor that got that statement in and take it for
correct.
What it was.
Correct. So that was not, I would not say that changed the defense of that defendant to now being a battered woman or some hybrid of a battered woman, and then the state didn't prove its case beyond a reasonable doubt. It just didn't come in that fashion because the court properly ruled that it couldn't come in absent an evidentiary foundation and some relevance to tie that event to what occurred in this case, which I would suggest would have been very difficult to have done. So the argument by counsel saying that this once again, is antagonistic defenses. It's not. It's not even remotely triggering that. So absent prejudicial.
So, Mr. Stanton, I have two areas of questioning. The first is, I assume Mr. Oren is correct in his characterization that the judge at one point indicated his grant severance and then consulted with the chief judge and without legal explanation rescinded that determination. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And is it also correct, as I understand the record in Mr. Oren's description, that the judge had conducted this sealed hearing in which you and Mr. Oren were excluded, and in so doing apparently learned something about the intentions of Schaefer to testify in the case? Mr. Oren argues that that the judge learning of Schaefer's intention to testify influenced his decisions with respect to the objections to the questioning of the detective. What's your view of that?
Well, I think that the issue of whether or not in the hearing, whether or not Ms. Schaefer was going to testify or not is rather irrelevant. because until that actually happened, the defense isn't properly before the court. And if she did testify, obviously there would be no basis to sever. Her failure to testify, I don't think, changed anything else for the court in making its ultimate conclusion, because the court never revisited the issue, never expressed any concern that somehow his ruling about not severing it was based upon a promise or a comment made by Ms. Schaefer's counsel that she was going to testify. I don't think in my reading of the sealed transcript or anything prior or subsequent from indicates that was the basis of the trial judge deciding the severance.
Then I'd like to turn to the language used in Bruton and Gray. In Bruton, the language seems to conclude that the Confrontation Clause is not violated as long as the co-defendant's statements do not explicitly implicate the co-defendant. But Gray seems to modify that and indicates that the removal of the defendant's name is so obvious that it is tantamount to directly implicating him. That seems to be the test. So in this instance, it seems to me we should be examining whether or not the qualifications surrounding statements made by Schaefer still were tantamount to directly implicating.
Well, I think there's a mixture there, but I would go back to Bruton itself. And in Bruton,
I'd like to stick with Gray, because Gray qualified the rule in Bruton.
Right, but in Bruton there was no redaction. And so right. But I think it's important contextually to understand Gray, because in Gray there was, at least by the jurisdiction that did that case, the manner in which they redacted it. Because it's clear from Richardson and Marsh that that's what bothered the court, and that is by leaving blanks in the transcript or in the evidence presented to the jury, it was the manner in which it was redacted was incriminatory. And that's what bothered the court, because then after that, the instruction was use of a neutral pronoun. And in fact, the Supreme Court gave an example of in Gray, which I'm sure you've read because it was right around that section that you just cited to, about, well, why couldn't the prosecution have just done this and inserted a neutral pronoun instead of the blank that was in the transcript admitted as evidence? But once again, that reaffirms the rule that it has to facially incriminate in the statement itself, not in context with all the other evidence deduced at trial or being familiar with the entirety of the record, that you can now say, well, it's quite clear that Ms. Schaefer was alluding to this person. That's not the test. The test is, what does the statement itself say?
But didn't Gray also implicate that the redaction, the aspect of whether the redaction is sufficient terms of the facts of the case?
Yes, and I think that's...
So why isn't that here?
Because just like in Zafiro, where you have multiple defendants, more defendants than two, it's not patently obvious who the redaction in a neutral pronoun context would be referring to. And so in this case, just like in Zafiro and all the other cases, absent the ones that counsel's citing to, are dealing with multiple defendants at trial in front of the 12. Not two, which would be arguably at least more incriminating about who that person is. Because if the test is the totality of the evidence adduced at trial, can you fill in the blanks, then Richardson, Gray, and Marsh have no meaning. Zero. Because you could never do it.
But you don't have a completely redacted statement here. I mean, that's the starting point. Just to quote a piece of it, I mean, at one point, they establish a relationship using Sitton's name, that she and Schaefer had, that Schaefer and Sitton had a relationship together. And just this practically the same page, Did she tell you that she would be trying to cook at the condo and the victim would come and make a pass at her, put his hand on her butt, and that was unacceptable to her? Yes. Question. Did she tell you that she had told somebody about that? Well, you've set the context by naming Sitton as the person with the dating relationship with Schaefer, and then you move in this to her telling somebody about Haskell making inappropriate, lewd-type gestures at her. It's hard for me, and I do think the context of the trial matters. I mean, it's hard to see how that could be anybody other than that somebody becomes Sitton and then throughout is somebody Sitton in that statement.
Well, I certainly think that it could be applied to her brother as well. I don't know how any of that subject matter would be exclusive to Mr. Sitton.
You mean his brother?
Yes, Mr. Sitton's brother. And whether how that would be exclusive to the appellant being the sole basis of the behavior that you're citing to.
Well, but they're saying that he, right after identifying Sitton, would actually come and visit her there, being Haskell's apartment, quite often. Yes. Spend the night sometimes. Yes. I mean, to me, it's so much more likely that it's Sitton than the brother.
I see your point. I see that there's an inference to be drawn, but I would submit that when you look at how that's redacted and the manner in which it's presented, once again, the question and the flow of this information is through a question and answer of the detective. This is not something where you're looking at the location of those comments and those questions in a transcript. This is done through a Q&A with the detective that's taking Ms. Schaefer's statement.
I mean, it almost reads as if you're thinking that she's going to be taking the stand and testifying, so you're not going to have a confrontation issue. I mean, I almost wonder, reading this redaction, whether that was the operative assumption.
Well, I can't speak for the two attorneys that were prosecuted, because I was not the prosecutors in this case. Yeah. But I can tell you that the anger that Ms. Lucich expressed, I don't think is about being excluded from the hearing, is based upon, as Mr. Orm says, speaking out of both sides of the state's mouth. Ms. Lucich and I prosecuted in a short time before this case the Amar Harris case, the non-death penalty sexual assault case that was reversed by this court because the trial judge applied the wrong standard in a closed hearing without the state being present, yeah. Ms. Lucich, myself, and we weren't there to protect the record or protect the case. And so our position about arguing that this hearing should not have been closed to the state or to Mr. Orm certainly was based in part on that, but I guess the question then becomes, is there any aspect of that closed hearing that would offend Mr. Sitton's rights? And once again, as our brief states, there's no authority cited to...
But it is troubling. The judge comes back and says on the record, nobody filed a written motion to exclude domestic violence evidence, so I'm not going to go there. Like, where did that come from?
Well, I don't know where it came from, but I can tell you that in my experience, in both the Second Judicial District Court and the Eighth Judicial District Court, judges are somewhat confused at times about whether severance is required in criminal cases. Part of that confusion, I think, has to do with the history of that issue through this court. I think part of that has to do with the confusion articulated in the Chartier case, which has a framework of the ultimate decision being that a specific denial of a defendant's trial right is a basis to sever, which I think is an accurate statement of the law in part granting severance. But the factual basis underlying that is completely flawed. There was no evidence that would not have been inadmissible through a joint trial or an individual trial, which was the linchpin of the decision in Chartier, that there was a wiretap recording that Mr. Chartier wanted to admit in the joint trial, and the judge, trial judge Stu Bell, denied it. He did not deny it, Judge Bell, on a basis that the trial was joined and that the co-defendant's rights would have been wrongfully infringed. He denied it because the wiretap was wholly inadmissible as a piece of evidence, which would have existed and did exist in trial number two. The state didn't object. I didn't object in trial number two because this court had already ruled that that should come in. So the basis and the underlying underpinning in Chartier is raises some confusion in the courts down below, which I think was the etiology of Judge Smith's wrestling with this issue and seeking guidance elsewhere.
Good thing. Any other questions for Mr. Stanton?
Thank you
from
very
the court?
Much.
Las Vegas, any questions there? Okay, Mr. Stanton, thank you very much. Mr. Orme, you have 11 minutes and 6 seconds remaining.
I'd like to address some of the statements I just heard from the prosecution. First of all, regarding severance, what did the state say regarding severance in their opposition to my motion for severance? And again, I am reading from page 25 of the brief. This is directly from their opposition. In the instant case, the state has no intention of utilizing Schaefer's statement against the defendant. Furthermore, the state would be permitted to redact the statements of either defendant such that the statement could be used against the defendant who gave it without implicating or referencing the other. That's their exact word, and I like that, the other, because that's what they continuously did in the trial, the other, the other, the other. The next thing I want to address is Mr. Stanton saying, well, some of these others may implicate Robert Sitton. I think the state right now is hoping that there's not a full understanding of the facts. Mr. Robert Sitton testified, I'm guilty of this crime in the second degree. I beat this man. I punched this man. I kicked this man. This man tried to hit me several times. But I did it with my brother. So the state's theory through Robert Sitton was, if you can picture it, Robert Sitton and Will Sitton were in there beating the man to death. So how does Jackie Schaefer's statement implicate them? Well, as I was listening to Mr. Stanton talk, I pulled out a few of the better ones. This is the detective being questioned about Jackie Schaefer. Did she say again that she didn't think they were going to hurt him that bad? Who's they? It's Robert and Will Sitton. It's mirroring Robert Sitton. It's obvious. Ms. Schaefer stated she was nervous when others were in Mr. Haskell's room. Who else could it be? You've established there's 4 people. Mr. Haskell can't be the one perpetrating it on himself. And Ms. Schaefer didn't go inside the room. So who are the others? Not other, others. So the reason I'm bringing that out is because Mr. Stanton just argued that maybe her statement, the jury thought maybe it was implicating Robert Sitton. Others? No, it was mirroring Robert Sitton. Robert Sitton was in that room with Will Sitton, beating the man to death. The other person came out and said the other person was cleaning. That's a reference to Jackie Schaefer talking about Robert coming out and claiming that Will is inside the room. It's obvious. It carries on further. Did she tell you they were going to leave town? Yes. And lastly, my argument was, and you heard Mr. Stanton say, the victim's, he said, stuff was located at my client's residence. That was a struggle during trial. I actually got the lease agreement for the residence, and it showed both Robert and Will. So my argument to the jury was, the victim's stuff is found where Robert put it. That was my argument. The prosecutor asked the detective for a statement. Ms. Schaefer claimed that Will's brother did not live with Will. So they just defeated my whole argument. Just like that, there was nothing I could do about it. Now I have Jackie Schaefer, my client's girlfriend, saying they don't live together. The lease agreement said otherwise, and I was trying to say Robert Sitton lived there. There's nothing I could do about that fact. Then we go to page 34 of my brief, and I hear the state arguing, you can redact in such a way that's constitutionally acceptable. Let me remind the state what this court said in Martin and Duxworth. The instant case is substantially similar to Stevens. The testimony of Kroll and Au was relevant only against Duxworth. However, in confessing, Duxworth mentioned an unnamed accomplice, and we conclude that the jury inevitably inferred that Duxworth's accomplice was Martin. And once you look at that language and look at the philosophy behind this court, then you ask yourself, when they were reading, when the jury was hearing Jackie Schaefer's statement through the detective, an unnamed others, we, they, can you conclude that the jury didn't think that was Will Sitton? It's obvious it was Will Sitton. And so under the circumstances, as I see it, that the state can't justify it. In the questionings I've heard of the court, the state cannot justify what I don't even really understand what was argued right now. In fact, is the state saying that jurors would not know that was Will Sitton? Because that is belied by logic. It's so obviously that
they're so. What he's saying is that you have to look at the statement separate from its the context of the trial. Do you agree with that? Or?
No, because that places jurors in a mental gymnastics that can't possibly be understood by a jury. Is a jury not to consider the other evidence as it comes in? In other words, when they're talking about Jackie Schaefer saying others were in the room, are jurors meant to think, what room are they talking about? I wonder if they're talking about a room at the Bellagio. I wonder if they're talking about the Supreme Court courtroom. Of course,
the redaction have been good, just exploring that, had no reference to Will Sitton and his relationship to Schaefer been introduced, if the statement had been fully sanitized of any reference to Will.
I think it would have been acceptable if it was sanitized as to any reference to anybody other than Jackie Schaefer, unless it was peripheral, like her daughter or her mother, where she said she'd come from her mother's home, something along those lines. But once you get into we and others and what's going on in that house, then it tells you.
And the fact that Sitton has been there, according to her directly, and that's the part that sort of opens the door, I guess.
Yes. And for me, when I was actually enduring this, it was painfully obvious. I don't, you know, it was so bad that I had to finally tell the judge, could I just, so I'm not jumping up constantly, just have a continuous objection, because I was concerned that the jurors are going to realize this guy's, the defense attorney's in a panic. He's panicking. And so I was trying not to and trying to keep calm. But the reality was, look at the situation. They're just incriminating the heck out of Will Sitton through Jackie Schaefer, and I couldn't stop it. And I can't confront it. And they've got an absolute mirror of a mirror of what Robert Sitton has testified to. They're just mirroring it. And they're doing what you said, just Pickering. They're picking and choosing what they're bringing out. As I put in my brief, they just cherry-picked the portions they want and the portions they needed. And remember, I was complaining to the jury, there's no corroboration of Robert Sitton, nothing. There's nothing that proves that he has done this. And what the state was so desperately trying to point out is one neighbor said that she had previously seen Will sitting there. Well, he's the boyfriend. He goes over there at times. So what? How is that incriminating to him? And how did that stifle my argument that it was Robert Sitton who went into a blind rage and killed this man? What stifled it was Jackie Schaefer's statement and their attempt to corroborate Will and to mirror Will. And so to me, it's obvious Bruton violation. It's blatant. And again, I want to reiterate, I'm not trying to say it's a pattern other than the one I brought forth. When Mr. Stanton stands here and says, we argued or we tried Denver's against each other, that's true. And I complained at that time, this is what they're doing. And it was found to be error by the court. It was found to be a Bruton error. It was nowhere near as significant as this one. But then they went back, and instead of heeding the warnings of the court, what do? They don't go back and say, hey, it was found to be error. We dodged a bullet. Oh, no. This is just an effort to go ahead and do it again and see if this time we can get the court to say harmless error with a man who's being sentenced to death. And that's what causes me grave concern, and that they really aren't citing a single case. They're not citing a single case that permits them to do this. What case have they cited saying that we can essentially, through others, implicate the defendant? And I just don't understand the argument here. It doesn't make any sense, the opposition. It's never made any sense. And what's happening here is more troubling than Bruton than the other cases cited, because you have the sealed hearing and you also have the district court judge consulting with another judge and then changing his mind. And that's also troublesome, because I want to argue to the Supreme Court today. I don't want to argue to somebody else outside who's going to come in here and interpret what I am arguing. I want to see facial expressions. I want to hear the questions. That's why we argue to the judge, not so another judge leaves and then comes back and overturns himself. Sealed hearing, reversing himself, this type of blatant error, it should result in reversal of this man's death sentence, his murders, or his murder conviction. And I would ask, if there are no further questions, that you reverse this.
Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Orme from Carson City? How about from Las Vegas? Any more questions there?
Yes.
No. No, in Las Vegas?
No.
Thank you. Thank you, colleagues there. So the case will now stand submitted, and we'll be in recess until 2:30 p.m.